Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. This week, we revisit some of Team Triad Arts' choice recent interviews and get a musical look at this Earth Day weekend. Guitarist David English is one of the performers at the Piedmont Earth Day Fair, and we'll join him in conversation with David Ford and learn about the art of building the cigar box guitar. Our celebration of Mother Earth continues with Mark Freund. He's conducting the fourth annual presentation of the Misa Gaia. Then we'll get a little silly and confusing with author Lemony Snicket, that is, if he even shows up. Mr. Snicket crafted the wildly popular A Series of Unfortunate Events novels, and now he's inking out his peculiar craft in the world of detective fiction. We keep the pen close to paper with acclaimed graphic novelist Hope Larson and a look at her adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. Then we wrap things up with acclaimed cellist Matt Heimovitz. Matt explores the sonic limits of the cello from Bach to Hendrix with indie rock detours along the way. All that coming up when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. We've got cellist Matt Heimovitz, comic book artist Hope Larson, and author Lemony Snicket on the way. But first, executive producer David Ford takes us on a musical celebration of Mother Earth.
The cigar box guitar dates back to the early 1800s, where social gatherings of slaves often resulted in live music making with simple cigar box instruments. After the Civil War, ex-slaves and soldiers used found objects like wood boxes, string, broom handles, and tin cans, and baling wire from the shed or barn to make their instruments. Even through the Great Depression, when money was tight and few could afford a real guitar, the cigar box guitars continued on as early blues instruments of choice all across the Southern American Delta. In fact, it's been said that the great B.B. King himself got his start on a cigar box guitar with a broomstick handle and a single string. Black Owl Guitars in New Bern, North Carolina, is keeping this great music tradition alive. It's owned and operated by David English. And this Saturday, April 26th, he'll share demos of his instruments, many of them made with found objects from old farms and warehouses, and he'll perform on the main stage during the 9th annual Piedmont Earth Day Fair at the Dixie Classic Fairgrounds in Winston-Salem. The fair's from 10 to 5 with live music, green demonstrations and vendors, fun for kids, and some great healthy local food options. David spoke with me by phone last week from his studio in New Bern.
To make music, you can use all kinds of stuff that's just laying around, and that's kind of the idea. It's a very simplified instrument. I play that slide guitar. It's a stick in a box, and so I build one out of a tobacco sticks out of tobacco barns that they used to hang the tobacco to dry. And in fact, that sound clip that I sent you is actually, that's on a two-string cigar box guitar with the neck as a tobacco stick. And you can make a lot of noise on it. It plugs in, and you can put effects on it and stuff, but the look of it is just so simple and so easy.
Well, let's take a listen to it. This is Green River was the tune that you sent, and we're dealing with a fretless guitar, a piece of pipe for a slide, and we got David English playing and singing an original, Green River.
Down in Manchester, kind of way back in
playing the cigar box guitar, it kind of takes away the rules. You kind of throw the rules out the window, and it's the sound, and it really takes it back to a more simpler form of music that those guys who really kind of were back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they were making these new sounds. It takes it back to kind of that time to where, yeah, there's some rules to it. Yeah, the neck is so long, and the bridge and the nut are this far apart, sure. But you can kind of make the sounds. It's whatever goes, whatever sounds good to you. You know, the song we just listened to there, you know, it has a real blues element to it. It has some jazz elements to it. And but, you know, I play Queen, Johnny Cash.
Ground control to Major Tom.
You get out there, and I'm going to be playing this weekend down at the Earth Day Fair here. You get up on stage, and they say, well, he's going to play the cigar box. And they go, well, what, is he going to beat on it? Or what is this? Is this a drum routine or something? You get up there, and you pluck out, you know, a song that's familiar to everybody, and they go, wait a second, that's pretty cool, you know?
Well, it's a perfect fit for Earth Day Fair because it's basically you're a master builder but also a master recycler.
Well, it's something I try to keep is the element of those recycled parts, what they were doing 100 years ago. And so I use the old cigar box. I use the tobacco stick necks or any of the wood. It's just scrap wood, whether it's a deadfall that somebody gives me and I cut up or a piece of flooring that somebody's going to toss away. I've cut out all like chemical finishes on the guitar. So the stains I use are made of mud or I'll use hickory nuts and vinegar and maybe put a bolt in there and it makes this really cool barnwood color. Or I use a beeswax finish that I make. I get local beeswax here from a man who does organic bees. And so you get this. And the great thing about beeswax finish is you scratch your polyurethane, it's scratched. Beeswax, you can just buff the scratch out. And nobody even knows. You know, it kind of adds a little bit of character to the instrument, you know. And occasionally I'll put a whammy bar on, a tremolo bridge or a whammy bar you've seen on an electric guitar. I'll use an old spoon and jam it up underneath the bridge. And you can bend the string a little more and kind of have that really, you know, glam rock sound. So that's a really cool thing about making instruments from recycled things is the possibilities are endless. And I like that. It's important to me because we throw so much away, and I find stuff every day that I go, oh, man, that was the trash. I can use that for a guitar. It's perfect.
It ain't for your gym. Like I said, you don't mess around. Got a 2x4 in your pocket, Lord. You're gonna bring it down.
What grabbed you about the blues, David? That's some pretty authentic playing out there.
Well, I was just intrigued by it because there was so much improv that could be done on it. You know, you could move it around, you could make it sound like we wanted. It was edgy, it had a rough sound. I think that's what drew me to these instruments and that playing the blues on these instruments is that it has a real rough, original, authentic, and genuine sound. And I like that. It's a little bit gritty, and I think that people, when they hear that, they're like, oh man, you know, that's real music there. You know, it hasn't been tweaked and twerked in some kind of studio or whatever. It's just the real deal. It's the raw music, and I like that.
Look for David English during this weekend's Piedmont Earth Day Fair. He'll be at the Great Outdoor Provision Vendor tent, keeping it real with demos of his guitars, and he'll have some for sale as well. There'll be live music all day long at the fair, beginning at 11 in the morning with the band Afterjack, followed by Doug Davis and the Solid Citizens at 1. In full disclosure, Doug is the husband of WFDD's own Molly Davis, and Dobie will perform at 3:30. You can catch David English on the main stage with his favorite cigar box guitar at 2:20, and you'll find links to the complete Piedmont Earth Day Fair schedule at WFDD.org. And click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and if your Saturday morning and afternoon spent celebrating Mother Earth at the Dixie Classic Fairgrounds has just whetted your appetite for more, well, pianist Mark Freund has just the ticket for you that very evening. Mark teaches piano at Weaver Academy for Performing and Visual Arts, jazz at Guilford College, and he's also music director of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Greensboro. There on Saturday night at 7:30, he'll direct the UUC choir and an amazing jazz sextet in a performance of the Paul Winter Consort's Missa Gaia, Earth Mass. The message of celebrating our very human connection with all that this planet is, and how we relate to every living creature is so universal that people of all faith traditions, and even those who are not churchy, will feel comfortable in attending.
Right, so it's both an ecumenical service, but it's also an ecological service, so it's really broad and open to everyone, and everyone is welcome.
Making that connection for some folks, easy said, hard to do. How do we go about making these sorts of realizations, you know, habitual or part of who we are, just that message?
Music is always the key. It can surpass everything. Any kind of philosophical issues that one has, if you sit down and listen to music, it can take care of you and take you to places that words cannot. One of the wonderful things about Missa Gaia is that not only it uses the sounds of instruments, but it also uses the sounds of the animals and really makes it an ecological and bringing it to Mother Earth, to all of us. So like in the Kyrie, that one is the opening pieces, the actually howl of the wolf begins, and then that melody that that wolf is singing becomes the Kyrie that is sung and transferred to the soprano saxophone and to a cantor, and then it's picked up by several other voices as it goes on. So the inspirations of the animal songs themselves become the inspirations for the melodies.
You know, this ties in a little bit, and maybe I'm going on a limb here, to a Native American belief, this connection from the importance of nature and the importance of our own humanity.
Oh, very much so. And Will, with respect of the First People here, we do have one or two selections in there. One is My Child, I Am Your Mother Earth, that we'll be doing, that is Native American ties to it.
And more nature represented in the canticle as well.
Yes, the canticle is for brother son, and it's referring to St. Francis of Assisi, who's considered to be the patron saint of all the animals.
Unitarian Universalist Church of Greensboro music director, keyboardist, and educator Mark Freund. On Saturday night, he'll lead the UUC choir and an all-star jazz sextet in a performance of Missa Gaia, Mass in Celebration of Mother Earth. We've been sampling from this remarkable piece, first recorded and released by Paul Winter in 1982. Saturday's performance will feature many of the triad's most celebrated jazz artists, including saxophonist Wally West, cellist Scott Walker, pianist David Fox, guitarist Mark Mazzatenta, bassist Matt Kendrick, and drummer Greg Turian. The concert begins at 7:30, April 26th, at Unitarian Universalist Church of Greensboro. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later in the show, we'll hear the cello treated like an electric guitar and explore the artistry of one of today's leading illustrators. But up after the break, it's a conversation with Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The elusive author Lemony Snicket has written some of the most celebrated books for young readers of the past decade. The 13 volumes of A Series of Unfortunate Events have sold over 60 million copies worldwide and have been translated into 41 languages. They were also turned into a film in 2004 starring Jim Carrey. The latest series to be written by Lemony Snicket is called All the Wrong Questions. It's a 4-volume story set in the shadowy world of crime fiction. The second installment, When Did You See Her Last?, was released last fall. Lemony Snicket was scheduled to appear on the campus of Wake Forest University last fall, but unfortunately he was not able to attend. He also stood me up for this interview. But I have been assured it was for the best. I was told this by Mr. Snicket's representative, Daniel Handler. So while I cannot outright recommend you listen to the following interview with Mr. Handler, if you like to be disturbed, perplexed, or simply confused, the following may be of interest to you. I'm going to go ahead and say congratulations on the release of your newest book.
That's very sweet of you to think of me. It's a book about a kidnapped girl, so I think a cause for a celebration that a book about a kidnapped girl is loosed upon the world seems to be a little inappropriate, but if that's your level of professionalism, I'll try to adjust.
That's as professional as I can get. I'm sorry.
Oh dear. No, it's quite all right.
When Did You See Her Last is the second in the All the Wrong Questions series.
It's true. The first is Who Could That Be at This Hour?, which is about a stolen statue that turns out not to have been stolen, and so the statue must be stolen so that the case of the stolen statue can be solved. And then the second volume is When Did You See Her Last?, about a girl who goes missing, who turns out maybe to perhaps to want to go missing, although isn't the same girl as the girl they thought was missing. That was a confused pause you took, and I understand that it's complicated and upsetting, as the work of Lemony Snicket appears to be to nearly anyone who reads it.
Now, some of the characters in All the Wrong Questions have inadvertently been introduced to some unprescribed drugs, haven't they?
Well, it's true. Laudanum, a drug that makes people drowsy and occasionally unconscious, is a device used by various villains in All the Wrong Questions in this new series. But I wouldn't call it really a recreational drug. I guess it's a recreational drug for the villains. I hadn't thought of it that way. They enjoy knocking people unconscious, the better to drag them into unpleasant situations. I guess that counts as a recreational drug.
So what drew you to the going the noir genre route for young readers?
Well, one day I was reading a noir novel by Raymond Chandler, and it suddenly hit me that the journey of a detective is virtually identical to the journey of a child. A person is told by various authority figures to complete various tasks that turn out to be more sinister and complicated than they thought, and then they're told to lay off the case and stop asking questions, and soon they need to find their own moral path in a world that is completely corrupt and treacherous. That's basically the same thing that we all go through when we're born and adults begin bossing us around. So I thought it would be interesting to go back in time when Mr. Snicket was a young lad and an apprentice in a secret organization and think about when he was up to the various nefarious deeds that eventually made him the broken and Byronic figure that we come to know and shudder over in a series of unfortunate events.
What is it about putting children in these dangerous situations that appeals to you?
What appeals to me about putting children in dangerous situations?
Well, in your novels. Nothing,
I think when you're reading a book and people are in danger, it's interesting. I think when you're in life and people are in danger, it's another thing altogether. That's why I find that the Snicket books tend to lead to people putting themselves in danger in real life, and that's why personally I'm against them. But, you know, other people host radio shows and talk positively about books in which young girls go missing. That's other people's moral choices. I try not to judge.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about something I'm curious about with a series of unfortunate events.
Sure.
It was turned into a film starring Jim Carrey as Count Olaf. What are your feelings about how the adaptation turned out?
Well, the movie combines three volumes of a series of unfortunate events into 2 hours. So the pain and suffering in about 600 pages of material is condensed. And so whether you want to read the books and have that suffering drawn out, but perhaps to a lesser degree with every passing moment, or you prefer to have your pain and suffering concentrated like that, I think it depends. It really depends on whether you're the sort of person who likes to rip the Band-Aid right off, or whether you like to slowly, slowly pull it.
Well,
which are you?
Rip it right off.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money, he's never at all funny. He wants to remove your face. And you might be thinking.
Let's talk about music a little bit.
Okay.
So you play accordion.
I do.
How did you get your start playing accordion?
I was in college, and I had taken piano for years, and I wanted to be in a band, and it was during a brief moment in American musical history when no keyboard instruments were cool, so I took up the accordion so I could be in a band. So I like to say that I'm one of the few people who ever took up accordion basically to meet women. I'm married now, so it all worked out fine.
Yeah, that
definitely
worked out. Now, you've collaborated with Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Field on a number of occasions.
I have.
How did that collaboration start?
It started with my admiring of his work and moving to New York, where I knew that he lived. And through various vague circumstances, I was introduced to his manager, and I said, oh, I really like Stephen Merritt, and I would like to work with him. And she said, well, he goes to the same diner every day where he sits and writes songs. You could just go find him there. So I went and found him there, and I looked up and I said, hello, I'm Daniel Handler, and I admire your work very much. And he said, what are you reading? And I said, oh, The Spoils of Poynton by Henry James. And he said, well, that's never been my favorite Henry James novel. And then we started talking, and we still talk.
That's great. And then you've played on some Magnetic Fields recordings or things with the Archie?
Yes. Right when we were first becoming associates, I had just had the idea for a series of unfortunate events, and he had just had the idea for 69 love songs. So we ended up helping each other. He wrote one song for each volume in a series of unfortunate events, which were collected as The Tragic Treasury by one of his bands, the Gothic Archies. Now have to call the Gothic Arches because of a cease and desist order from Archie Comics.
Oh.
And thanks, Archie Comics, for spoiling our party. We appreciate it. And then I played accordion on 69 Love Songs and a few other Magnetic Fields records also, and I tour with them when it's convenient and when they're going to a glamorous location. It's really quite a deal for me when they call me and they say, we're going to London to perform 69 Love Songs at the Hammersmith Ballroom. Would you like to come? I say, but of course. And when they say, we'll be touring the Midwest in the middle of the searing heat. Would you like to come? I say, oh, I wish I could. I'm so busy. Rat.
Yeah, you've ironed out a perfect deal with Mr. Merry, it seems.
Yeah.
People gawk at the way you walk, you're a freak show. People squawk about the way you talk, you're a freak show.
Some more recent works. You worked on a children's, you know, younger children's book, The Dark.
Yeah, it's a picture book. Mr. Clausen, the award-winning illustrator of such books as This Is Not My Hat and I Want My Hat Back, moved on from hats to more darker material in our book, The Dark, which is the story of a boy named Laszlo who is afraid of the dark, and then the dark starts speaking to him. It's a terrifying work, and so was for some reason marketed towards very young children.
How does that kind of collaboration work with an illustrator like that, especially when it is a picture book, so driven by the images and for younger children? Are you doing it in tandem, or do you write the text and he supplies the illustrations?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I've also worked with Myra Kalman, who is a very skilled illustrator, and she and I had a collaboration. But John Clausen is basically a worthless, treacherous human being. And so I had to hold his hand and boss him around and, you know, offer him ridiculous incentives to keep going. He's a big fan of the food of P.F. Chang's, and so I would have to offer him, you know, chances to have pot stickers or things like that if he only continued his work. So it was really quite difficult for me, and despite the fact that he appears to be a very charming and competent person and have won many awards and have best-selling books that he's written and illustrated all by himself, he really needed to be treated like an infant.
Hmm. Will you be working with him again in the future, or are you
Yeah,
done?
I will. Oh, lots of times I will, yeah. Okay. I wouldn't trust him to wander around by himself, frankly. Mm. For this tour, he won't be accompanying me, so I had to take him to a bus station and tell him to stay there for about a month.
When I was preparing for the interview, I discovered that you've written some books for adults as well, which I did not know that, such as Why
I'm Sorry, I should have written you, but I haven't been in touch with you the way I've liked.
No one told me about Why We Broke Up and Adverbs and Watch Your Mouth. Do you have a separate audience for these books, or is it, you know, the parents of the children that read a series of fortunate events, or is it the kids, you know, sneaking it into the house that like your other books?
Well, kind of both. The more I go out on tour, though I don't appear to age myself, I meet many people who say they have grown up with my books who appear more or less to be adults, and now they're reading some of those books. But there's always been a loyal, they describe themselves as a cult following. I'm not comfortable with that because, you know, it's not like they live in isolation, worship me as a god, despite my encouragement. But there is an audience for those books, and they come out. So I think there's a little bit of a Venn diagram between the work of Daniel Handler and the work of Lemony Snicket.
Okay.
I'm sorry you were unaware of it, though. That makes me feel bad.
Well,
I should have written you a postcard, at least. Where were my manners? Do you think our friendship can survive this?
I think it can. I think it definitely can.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yes.
Then I won't worry about it anymore.
All right. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome. Thank you for your interest. I hope nothing terrible happens to you today.
I have known little civility, sir.
Author Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. His latest book, When Did You See Her Last?, will soon be released in a paperback version. He also recently set up a new annual U.S. prize, quote, honoring a librarian who has faced adversity with integrity and dignity intact. The Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity will remind readers everywhere of the joyous importance of librarians and the trouble that is all too frequently unleashed upon them. For more on Lemony Snicket and this award, visit WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend.
When you play the violin.
Let's continue now in the world of words, but how about we add some pictures to this radio show? Illustrator and cartoonist Hope Larson is one of the most celebrated comic book artists of her generation. She's won two Eisner Awards, which are the equivalent of an Oscar for the comic book world. Her first was in 2007 for talent deserving of wider recognition, and last year she won for Best Publication for Teens for her graphic novel adaptation of the classic A Wrinkle in Time. Most recently, Hope wrote and directed a short film called Bitter Orange, starring Brie Larson. Hope is from Asheville, North Carolina, and visited Greensboro last year to take part in the Geek Girl Rising panel at Comic Book City Con. Hope Larson now lives in L.A., where she spoke with Bethany Chafin by phone.
The book A Wrinkle in Time is near and dear to me, as I'm sure it is to a lot of people. I was wondering if you had a relationship with that book before you started the project of adapting it into a graphic novel.
Yeah, that book was a really big deal to me growing up. I think that was maybe the first sci-fi book that I read, or one of the first ones. Her voice as a writer and those characters really got to me. I went on to read the rest of the quintet, the Time Quintet. And those were books that I read and reread through my childhood and adolescence. So it was an incredible honor being tapped to work on the graphic novel adaptation.
What is it like to adapt a work rather than maybe start from scratch and create something that's your own? And I know that your adaptation is your own, but is it a completely different process or are there some similarities?
It's both really similar and really different from writing something original. In terms of the writing, the script that I did includes pretty much everything that's in the book. Very little was taken out or changed at all because we wanted to stay true to the novel. It's like, it's a beautiful novel. And if you start taking stuff out, it just falls apart. And we didn't want to mess it up. So I definitely felt like my hands were tied, but, you know, I wanted them to be tied for the writing part of the process. But when I sat down to draw, it felt the same as drawing any other book that I've done. You're using different parts of your brain. It's a completely different process than writing.
What else were you reading as a young girl that inspired you?
As a kid, I read C.S. Lewis's work, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and those books, Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander. I read some Tolkien. I read a lot. I was one of those kids who would go to the library and come home with like 15 books and read them all in a week. So I don't even remember half the stuff that I read.
When you were younger, what, or even, you know, whenever you started drawing and writing, was it the image that came first and then maybe you realized you wanted to be adding some writing to that? Or were you a writer and you realized I can really bring this to life with some pictures?
I have early memories of dictating stories to my dad and him typing them up, and then I would do the illustrations. I guess before I even knew how to write, I was working this way. Yeah, I think for me, it starts with the story for sure, but I'm always writing with an eye to it being a visual story later on. So that's always the goal, is fitting the pictures to the words. I've never written a novel or anything. I've never really done prose, but I've written a lot of scripts. I've written screenplays, and I've written all the books that I've drawn. I think that I'll probably write a novel someday, but I'm so inspired by the interplay of words and pictures that I kind of want to stick with that for the most part.
You mentioned writing scripts, and I recently watched Bitter Orange. What was that experience like, making a short film?
It was amazing. It was amazing. I actually did a year at film school, my first year of college, and it wasn't really the right time for me to be working in that medium, I don't think, as a person. But coming back to it at 29, 30, 31 has been really fantastic because I feel like I've grown into myself, and I'm much more comfortable being in charge of a crew and working with actors. And I'm playing with a lot of the same ideas of words and images that I'm playing with in comics. So it feels like a fairly natural sidestep.
Do you plan on doing more film in the future?
I'd love to, yeah. That's definitely the goal. I don't want to leave comics or anything, but I would love to do both, to write and direct for film and to continue writing and drawing comics as well.
When you wrote about receiving your Eisner, you mentioned a lot of the up-and-coming female talent in your industry, that there were just kind of amazing things to come from them. Could you talk about maybe who some of those people are?
I think I mostly mentioned people who are friends of mine who are not even so much up-and-coming as they have come.
Right, and they were others who were perhaps nominated or not, but, you know, worthy of an Eisner, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, there are just so many amazing female cartoonists working right now. Meredith Grand, Lucy Nisley, Erica Mullen, Dylan McConis, Vera Broswell, Jillian Tamaki, and Mariko Tamaki. It's just a really, it's a wonderful time to be a woman working in comics.
Illustrator and cartoonist Hope Larson. She spoke with Bethany Chafin last year just before she took part in the Geek Girl Rising panel at Comic Book City Con. For more on Hope and to see her short film Bitter Orange, starring Brie Larson, no relation, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. After the break, you're in for a musical adventure as world-renowned cellist Matt Heimovitz takes us from the concert hall to the stage of CBGB when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. Cellist and multiple Grammy winner Matt Heimovitz has inspired classical music lovers and countless new listeners by bringing fresh music to concert halls, rock clubs, outdoor festivals, intimate coffee houses, just about anywhere you can reach listeners with passionate performances of world-class music. Last September, Matt brought that passion to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro Recital Hall as part of the 17 Days Festival, where Matt explored everything from classic Jimi Hendrix tunes to an unaccompanied Bach cello suite. During this segment, you'll also hear Matt's take on tunes by Blonde Redhead and Arcade Fire. He spoke with David Ford by cell phone last fall.
Well, it seems like you've really, over the last several years, arrived in a fantastic place in terms of your performance career. What do you say to the venerable, you know, old teacher or naysayer who says to you, you know, Matthew, you could have had a real cello soloist career performing the great cello rep with orchestras all over the world all the time. Why this? Why Hendrix in a coffee house? How do you break it down for that perspective, someone from leaning that way?
For the most part, an artist of any generation, no matter how venerable, they understand the responsibility of keeping the tradition alive and passing it on. My own teacher, Leonard Rose, I often imagine, what would he say, you know, hearing my Jimi Hendrix arrangement? However, I think in the end he would understand, because I think he would understand that I'm going out and building new audience. You know, he would know that my generation has different challenges than his generation, and that the ultimate goal is to keep the tradition going and to keep it healthy and breathing and alive and to communicate on any given day to however many people to share this music. I think most artists understand that, no matter what generation they come from.
Could you give me an example of a piece or venue that worked, you know, even better than you had hoped in terms of audience engagement?
Well, it always surprises me when I play Elliot Carter in the context of, you know, I'll always play Bach, and of course that just never fails. I mean, if I play a Bach cello suite, that always universally connects with an audience. But sometimes I'll include an Elliot Carter figment, 5 minutes long, and, you know, I'll think people might walk out. They don't. But I always prepare it, you know, with, like, If you hate this, in 5 minutes it's over, and so it's kind of like reverse psychology.
I should point out for non-classical musicians that Elliot Carter, the late great Elliot Carter, a 20th century composer who really was an intellectual composer par excellence, but his music maybe not the most accessible.
Just, he's an uncompromising composer, very influenced by jazz and other elements, but like you said, very complex, many layered, you know, a lot of stuff happening all at once, counterpoint. But on first hearing, you might say, oh, that's the kind of music that is responsible for turning audiences off to contemporary classical music. But again, in context, after hearing Bach, then hearing the Elliot Carter, it always amazes me that people really can connect with it, because it's so visceral, it's so kinetic, and somehow the drama of the contrast with the Bach is so extreme. And just seeing what the range of the instrument can do, and things are flying by really fast, and so even though people might not comprehend at first listen, they do latch on to something very very energetic and immediate. That always surprises me. You know, my one failure, well, I'm sure I've had more than one failure, but one,
that's
one
a great
that comes
record.
To mind is on a rock and roll tour years ago. I was the only classical musician, and I was opening the show, and I thought, oh man, I have to be really cutting edge and hit. And so I started with all my contemporary stuff, and the promoter came back to me after that first show, and he said, you know, all the contemporary stuff is really great, but do you mind giving us a little love at the start of the program? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, could you play a little Bach? I was like, really? On a rock and roll show, you're asking me to play Bach? And so I learned my lesson. You know, I think that basically you can take it in any direction you want, but giving people a little love first is always a good idea.
Giving a little love. That's great. I'm wondering, Matt, traveling the country as you do by car, occasionally playing these concerts and performing Bach solo works for cello to a whole host of different venues, what kind of insight has that given you about this country, about the people who live here? I mean, that's you've got to have, in some ways, your finger on the pulse of what's going on out there.
I love driving, and I love driving through the United States. It's so diverse. There's so much beauty of landscape and different landscapes, different cultures. You know, it's amazing how filtered the view is of what we get, you know, in terms of red and blue states. It does not exist when you are traveling by car and stopping at a truck stop and having conversations with truckers and then, you know, having other kinds of conversations at venues with people. And one thing that I realize is every community, no matter how, you know, remote it is from a major urban center or whatnot, there's always people who are interested in expanding their intellectual view or their just sense of curiosity or expanding their musical input and taking a chance on discovering new music or adventurous music.
Give me a sense of some of the different places you've played throughout your life, Matt. Could you give us the variety of the venues that you've chosen throughout the years?
One of my favorites, Seattle Tractor Tavern. It's a honky-tonk bar in Seattle. Churchill's in Miami is in the middle of a Haitian slum. It's a great, great venue. Uh-huh. CBGB, of course, in New York, which is now defunct, but you know the birthplace of punk, whole punk movement.
What drew you to Jimi Hendrix?
Definitely the electric guitar with his music. I mean, when I heard the Star Spangled Banner, I was in my first year of college when I heard it first time, and it just blew me away. And then, you know, getting to know some of the tunes, I mean, a Machine Gun, great war protest song, and just the sheer, this raw energy to it. The guitar playing is really, as an instrumentalist, I'm really into it in terms of the virtuosity, the power of it, just the sound. Yeah. Sound that he was creating and distortion, all that.
Performance, which is really incredible, and you get a chance to see it on YouTube, like, at least excerpts. We'll post the link there. I can't even see in the picture. Are you utilizing pedals, or is this all harmonics and stuff you're working with the instrument? So,
no, it's totally acoustic.
Wow.
I wasn't using any pedals, and I rarely use pedals. I'm more interested in trying to get the effects acoustically and how it translates. How do I play wrong to get those interesting sounds out of the instrument?
It's amazing.
So, yeah, it's definitely acoustic. And
is it tough shifting from Hendrix to Bach? And what are those transitions like in performance for you?
You know, no, because, I mean, I basically subscribe to the Duke Ellington philosophy of music. There's two kinds of music. There's the good kind and the other kind. And so for me, it's part of one trajectory. I program carefully, but it's the same wiring involved.
Cellist and multiple Grammy winner Matt Heimovitz. You'll find links to his performance schedule on WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. You can also learn all about Matt's latest multimedia project, an educational CD, book, and app for children titled Angel Heart. Well, that wraps up today's show. Our executive producer is David Ford, our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Andre Wallace. If you missed part of today's episode or would like to share what you heard, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can find us on Twitter, too. Our handle is Triad Art Speak. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions to share, please send your email to triadarts@wfu.edu. Have a great Earth Day weekend, everybody. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.